Georgia Dunstan is one of the top geneticists in the U.S. today. She's been at it now for 40 years, and yet she brings to her work the same enthusiasm as a grad student.
I do believe that what we are approaching with our science is really unfolding the process of moving from the formless to the form, or from the invisible to the visible. And we're encroaching on the rules that govern creativity, if you will.
Georgia Dunstan takes her study into the sensitive area of examining variations in the genetics of African Americans. She's determined to search out the kind of distinctions that will improve healthcare, distinctions that might be buried in a better understanding of who we all are and where we all come from. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The science of understanding the value of what is buried in our DNA is still in its early stages. This work's been underway ever since science programs like NOVA announced the breakthrough of the last century.
For the past 10 years, scientists all over the world have been painstakingly trying to read the tiny instructions buried inside our DNA. And now, finally, the human genome has been decoded.
We're at the moment the scientists wait for. This is what we wanted to do. We're now examining and interpreting the genetic code.
Georgia Dunstan is one of the genome pioneers. She's a professor at the College of Medicine at Howard University, working to help us understand not only who or what we are, but why it matters.
It is very clear to me that the genome essentially deals with two fundamental areas, inheritance and identity. And inheritance for me deals with source, where you come from. So in a very real way, the science itself is now coming head on with the questions of who am I? Where did I come from? And so now we have the best minds and the best technologies that our Western science has to offer, trying to grapple with those same questions.
Georgia Dunstan started asking those questions as a young girl at a segregated, at an all-black elementary school in Virginia. By the time she was in junior high school, the laws were changing. Many of her fellow students were being bused across town to integrate a white school. Georgia says her name wasn't on the busing list, and that was just fine with her.
I grew up at a time when the differences in the accommodations, where the school, where the church, whatever, the marked contrast between the quality of books, libraries, what have you, that the whites had the better of everything was just part of my reality.
Were you envious of the kids that you knew who were bused off to the white schools?
Oh, no, not at all. Not the least. I have no recall of folk lining up, raising their hands to be bused.
Although we look back at the history in a kind of calculated way now and say, mm-hmm. They had better books or they had fewer kids in the class. That wasn't a part of the way you saw it?
No. I think it's fair to say that because the better conditions were not part of my experience, I didn't realize what the disadvantages were. Just like I never knew we were poor. And so that's kind of the way it was.
What was it that your parents expected, Georgia? Did they expect you to graduate from high school and go on to college? Was that your expectation?
Oh, my parents just wanted me to finish high school. Neither had finished high school. So to have their kids finish high school was an achievement.
During her senior year at high school, Georgia Dunstan ranked in the top percent of her class academically. She was class valedictorian. And so even though her parents had hoped that she would simply graduate high school, Georgia had bigger plans, and she had the grades to get a scholarship to go on to college.
Everybody was happy. It was wonderful. Absolutely. Especially since I got a scholarship. And I was the smart one. So I had done well in school, so they were definitely not surprised that I ranked in the top percent of the class, and they were absolutely ecstatic, yes.
And what was it that you were thinking that you would study at college?
I've always been curious about differences in people, and perhaps influenced by my environment is color differences. In church, I was just as inquisitive and had a reputation for asking questions that my Sunday school teachers and pastor couldn't answer. Likewise, at home, asking my mom, and I would ask my mama, Mom, why did God make me black? And why did he give me this characteristic or that characteristic? And I one of the things that I treasure is I remember one time when my mama just got a little fed up with the question, and she says, Georgia May, I don't know why God made you black or why he made you a girl, but I tell you what, you ask God any questions you have and let him tell you. And that is essentially what I began to do. I would ask God. And I lived in an environment where I expected God to answer.
This sounds like more that you were headed for a degree in philosophy than anything else at college.
It's very interesting you would say that, because I don't hesitate to say, yes, I very much loved philosophy. I loved reading the writings. I loved the questions about life. Why is life? Who is God? What is man? Why are we here? Those were the questions that really I wanted answers for. And I remember actually in junior high, I was talking with one of my counselors, and she knew my love for knowledge and understanding. And I told her, I said, I wanted to be a philosopher. And she said to me, she says, well, you know, I don't know any black philosophers, so I don't think that that would be an area where you would likely to get a job. But I was also coming up doing fantastic focus on science. And she told me, she says, your curiosities are good, but if you're going to get a job, it would probably be to your advantage to focus your interest in science. And so for me, because I was always interested in life and meaning and purpose and these kind of whys, biology was the natural direction for me to go, because I understood it to be the science of life, of living things. So that began my seeking to get a better understanding of life.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. There were a number of women studying biology at Norfolk University at the time when Georgia Dunstan was there. After she graduated, she took her new degree to New York City, expecting to land a job as a scientist. And there she found that those doing the hiring were often more interested in her skin color than her academic credentials.
There are lots of jobs available, at least advertised in the paper. And I even went to employment agencies looking for my ideal job. After all, I had my BS degree in biology. And I had a rude awakening that a BS degree in biology, at least for me, did not open the doors for the kind of job that I thought was waiting for me.
What happened?
Well, I lived with an aunt while I was there, and I searched daily. I get the paper, circle the jobs, go in for the interview, and repeatedly, the job that I was looking for was not available. And just simple as that, it's not available. However, they often were quick to indicate that job wasn't available, but they had some other type of openings. And repeatedly, the kinds of openings they had were not what I was looking for.
What were they offering you, Georgia?
For the most part, they would be something related to a cleaning type job.
Did you ask them if the other members of their cleaning staff were college graduates as well?
No.
I mean,
no. No. That never occurred. I can just remember a typical, oh, we're sorry, but that job has been filled. But we can see what else we may have that you might be interested in. Would you like for us to check? And, of course, I'm looking for a job. I need work. And they would check, and they say, now we have something here, maybe a waitress or where you would be part of the cleaning service. Whatever the type was, it wasn't what I had in mind that would be reflective of my 4 years in college with very good grades.
Did you ever lose your temper getting these kinds of answers?
I grew up in the South where my point is,
yeah,
I'm
but you're
sure
in New York now. You can you.
I'm in New York. It's funny. Yes, I had dyed my hair red, and it was miniskirt time, and so I was in New York. But after several repeated experiences, it became clear to me that there was a relationship between my being black and not getting these jobs.
Did you go home with your tail between your legs?
Oh, I certainly did. If it were not for family and friends, it would have been a total bomb, shall I say. And so I went to the university and spoke to my mentor, and I told him how disappointed I was. And I remember the conversation with him. He handed me the science magazine, the same science journal that is published today. He handed me, he said, you know, I was looking into science and I saw that Tuskegee University is still offering fellowships for the fall semester. Now, this was in August, the end of the summer. And he said, even though it's late, I think you should apply.
You know what they say about stuff happening for a reason. Georgia Dunstan went to Tuskegee and on to Michigan and on to become a true pioneer in the study of the human genome. And I'll talk more with her about what she's learned in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Here's a handful of science questions for you. Why is it that white people are more prone to having cystic fibrosis? Why is it that blacks are more susceptible to sickle cell anemia? Why is it that cancer researchers are identifying different kinds of breast cancer that seem specific to race? These are the questions at the forefront of the study of genetics today, and Georgia Dunstan is one of the leaders in this field. Her own curiosity started when she was a young girl at a segregated school in Virginia. Back then, all her parents hoped was that she'd finish high school. But a fellowship at Tuskegee took her to Alabama, where she fell further in love with science. It was also a time when she just plain fell in love.
Remember now, I went to undergraduate school at home. So for me, Tuskegee was the first time away from home on a college campus. So the very first evening, I tell you, the very first evening I was on campus, this young man came up and I obviously looked like I didn't know my way. So he says, can I help you? And I told him I was looking for my dorm. And he says, oh, I can show you where the dorm is. So he said, I'll check on you to show you around or what have you. I thought that was very nice. The bottom line is we got to be very, 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 very good friends and became like what they would call an item. We were always together. So I was in love. He told me he was in love too. But we were just always together. And when it came time for graduation, commitments and relationships that he had prior to meeting me surfaced. And my thinking that we would automatically get married and I would do whatever was available for me to do that would be supportive and respectful of our life together was kind of how I thought the story would end. But that wasn't to be. And I often look back reflectively now and just recognize how life unfolds in the midst of life, shall I say, because That summer that I was finishing, I had to take both biochemistry lab and lecture. And it was truly a godsend for me in the sense that the laboratory was the only place on the campus that I felt that I could be where I wouldn't be encountering persons or in places that I had previously spent time with him and friends on campus.
You were nursing a pretty broken heart, it sounds like.
I was nursing. I confess, it was my first broken heart, and it was broken. It was shattered. I went home, and I cried so much. My mom, bless her heart, but in any way, my heart was broken. I will admit that. But I was at another one of those points in terms of this isn't going to happen. So I kind of did what I do best. I threw myself into my work. And that summer, a professor from the University of Michigan, never forget that man. But anyway, he came to teach biochemistry. And I spent time in the lab, extra time, because I wanted to avoid people, quite honestly.
I know where this is going. He thought you were the most dedicated student he'd ever
seen. Did. He even said that to me. He was so impressed with the time I spent. I think he even said I was repeating experiments that I had already completed satisfactorily. And that's exactly what happened. This man looks at me and he truly thinks that I am just love biochemistry. And so at the end of the summer, I sailed to the top. I got A. And he said, have you ever thought about the terminal degree? Now, don't laugh. But the only terminal degree that we kind of thought about was the MRS. Okay. But there was this sense that one of the things that can happen at college is you meet the person that you're going to marry. But I knew that wasn't what he was talking about.
Georgia Dunstan did indeed go on to study in greater and greater detail the scientific structure of what it is to be human. It was the kind of research that finally helped her answer some of those questions that had bothered her since she was a girl.
I really wanted to understand God. I want to understand his love. I want to understand why he made me, what he made me for, what have you. And if we fast forward to now in the field of genetics, especially human genetics, when the whole Human Genome Project came forth in science, and the questions raised, what does it mean to be human? What defines human? And now we grapple with who is human. And we're trying to still answer those questions. And I even experienced today questions of what is black and what is African American. And we see differences of opinion as to whether or not race is a real construct in biology. So the questions of identity that have been provoked by the Human Genome Project overlap with those questions that I was asking in a very childlike way.
All right, I want to go back to those questions you raised as a high school girl when you were talking about, you know, does God love those white children more than he loves black children? Why are people mm-hmm. black, white, tall? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've now spent 40 years immersed in this, Georgia. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that little teenage girl now?
There is no question about God's love for all of humankind. It's just humbling to me that I come to a point in my science, even today, as I was talking about a research grant that I really, truly want to write. And what my heart wants to write is that the genome is more about our connection to the universe than to the physical world that we focus entirely on right now. I mean, I can actually see how the science is becoming the means, the tools for awakening us, if you will, to the fact that our inheritance is more in what is not seen than what is seen. I mean, that's humbling to me that we look at the sequence and we find that 98% of our inheritance is not expressed, or what we say in science is in non-coding regions. In other words, it doesn't make anything in the physical body that we see. And that raises philosophical questions to me, because I also see in the science how genomic science is bringing biology close to what I would call the fundamentals of theoretical physics.
So when you talk about our connection as humans to the universe, do you also mean our connection to each other as other humans? Is that a part of
it? Oh, absolutely. The genome dealt with that first. The thing that it showed first is that all humans are so similar. Take any two people from anywhere on the globe, anywhere, and line up their DNA, and the science, the numbers show that 99.9% of the sequence of our DNA is identical.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm talking with Georgia Dunstan. Her study of genetics has now brought her back to the stage where she's able to marry her two initial academic loves, that of science and philosophy.
We are at a juncture now, and it's exciting because it's not a stopping point, because I do believe that what we are approaching with our science is really unfolding the process of moving from the formless to the form, or from the invisible to the visible. And we're encroaching on the rules that govern creativity, if you will. The genetics has a chance to show us that we are naturally creative. This is what we're made to do. We move energy from the formless to the form. And the process for doing this is already built into the mechanism. We don't have to learn how to be creative any more than we have to learn how to breathe. It is built into the mechanism, but we have to come into the awareness. It's the level of awareness that separates us from experiencing it. And we're moving. We're moving there when we begin to do science that shows that a person's belief is the most powerful thing in the creative process. Belief is a force of the creative process. You have to believe it in order to have that mental template, if you will. But the universe is already organized to bring into being that which we believe. Like any seed, you put a seed in the ground. No one has to tell the seed how to go out into the earth and pull in the minerals that are needed for it to express that which is in the seed. We're living beings. This is part of a living process, and we operate the same way. We are beginning to recognize that we can't separate our inner world of thoughts, of feelings, of beliefs from our outer world of experiences. I'm one of those persons who believes that knowledge comes in time to solve problems. And so one has to ask, what is the problem that the Genome Project would provide solutions to? I happen to believe that there is a direct connection between the human genome problem and humankind's hunger to know who we are.
Dr. Georgia Dunstan is the founding director of the National Human Genome Center at Howard University. She's currently developing a database to help map biomedical features of African Americans. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Yesterday, you may have heard that I had a chance to sit down for an extended conversation here in the Story studio with our man from Baghdad, my friend Ahmed Abdullah Fadam. I first met Ahmed when I was in Baghdad back in the early months of the war, so I hadn't seen him for 5 years. And there you go.
So this is it.
This is my home.
It's Hey. Welcome to my home.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I thought a long, long time about having you sit down in this studio.
I didn't imagine myself sitting here, to be honest.
It's funny because when we play the diaries, you sound like you're there, but then you also sound like you're a long, long way away.
It's true.
So, good to have you here in the studio.
Thank you very much, my friend.
Ahmed has been keeping an audio diary for the story. Each time he files a new entry for Ahmed's diary, it's gripping.
When I took my son Muhammad to the hospital, all we could hear was screaming and howling. There were dead bodies lying in the corridors and wounded people screaming. I was trying not to let my six-year-old son, Muhammad, see such thing and hear such sounds.
Ahmed, as usual, arrived this week with stories, like this one about the immigration desk at JFK Airport in New York.
And I said, Assalamu alaikum. And he said, Alaikum salam. And I said, I'm an Iraqi, and this is my first time here, and this is my passport. And he said, you're from Iraq? I said, yes. And he said, okay, have a seat. I went and had a seat and kept waiting and waiting and waiting. He started calling names. He called everyone except me.
All the people who had come after you yes. got called before you.
So I went to him and I told him, sir, I have to catch my flight in 90 minutes. So do you think I'm going to make it? He said, so what? Have a seat. So he kept calling names until I was the only one left. And suddenly the guy grabbed his jacket and he said, I'm off for today.
And he left?
And he left.
With you alone in the room?
I was the only one sitting. Then an American officer came in. He found my passport. He read my name. He read that I'm an Iraqi. He came to me, shook my hand, and he told me, Ahlan wa sahlan fi America, in Arabic. Welcome to America. And all the procedures didn't take more than 10 minutes to finish my passport. And the guy before that kept me waiting for 4 hours.
After my conversation with Ahmed, we got a number of letters. Paula wrote to say, I've listened to Ahmed's stories and often wondered if he was a real person living the words or some composite of experiences from Iraqi journalists trying to tell the real story. Well, now I know. Did you hear the joy and relief in his voice? His interview with you was like a different person. May he and his family experience nothing but peace and safety for the rest of their lives. Dinah wrote from Battle Creek, Michigan, to, in her words, just say thank you for Ahmed's story. I'm so glad that he's here in the country and can have a break for a time. Somehow I feel you all probably helped get him here, and I'm so thankful. Every time his diary comes on, my world stops. I do nothing but sit and listen to him. He has helped shape my thinking about this war, war in general, and the world. It was amazing to hear him laugh. I hope he continues to do his diaries while he's here. And while he was here, Ahmed told me that one reason he was so eager to take a break from life in Baghdad came when he and his family got a death threat. He also told me in yesterday's conversation that while he's here, he wants to meet real Americans.
In Baghdad, I've seen many Americans. Some of them are journalists, and the rest are all people in uniforms, carrying weapons, driving tanks, sometimes pointing their guns against me. So me, as many other Iraqis, know nothing about the Americans except those people who we are seeing every day on the ground. People in uniforms carrying weapons. We don't know anything about the normal American citizens. So I'm going to try to use my time here to know as much as I can about the American life. I'm expecting that I'm going to spend most of my time just listening to people, to know the way they think, to know the way they feel, and go back to my people in Baghdad and start explaining to them the truth of the real American citizens in America.
Now, I have to say I was touched by the kind of generous responses we got to that. Judith wrote to say, I've been listening to, crying with, offering prayers in my heart for Ahmed Abdullah and his family during many of the readings from Ahmed's diary on the story. I will still offer my family as a source. We're all ages, from my 82-year-old mother through my husband and my adult offspring and their husbands to our 6- and 9-year-old grandchildren. And Janice wrote from L.A. to say she's always tuned to KPCC there, in the house and in the car, and she says, my stomach hasn't quite unclenched after the broadcast of the interview with Ahmed. I think I haven't heard his prior broadcast, but this was a wonderful program. I hope he listens well to all of us who hate this war and regret what ruination we've brought to his country, and he learns of our attempts to bring this all to an end. And Bennett wrote from northern Vermont to offer Ahmed a few days in the green hills there with the cows and a private pond and Bennett's 2-year-old son. I should say that Ahmed is still settling in here in Chapel Hill, but he does hope to do some traveling around the United States, so keep your eyes and ears open. And thanks to all of you for those gestures of welcome. I am passing them along to Ahmed. Coming up next on the program, another story of a man here in America who displays his own courage and determination. He's been blind since he was a young boy, and yet he plans to run in the Paralympics this summer in Beijing. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Many of the world's elite athletes are looking at the next few weeks as the most important in their lives. They'll be competing in Olympic trials for a chance to represent their country at the Beijing Olympics. Now, though we tend to focus mainly on the main games, the Paralympics are gaining prominence. And today I'm talking with the track star Alexis Gillette. Lex, as his friends call him, is blind. And when he's racing, he runs side by side with a guide. Lex is actually tethered to this other top runner, Wes Williams, who will talk him through the race. Lex was telling me about one such race when their signals got crossed.
And we were running a 200, and you know you have to, like, curve in the inside. And I can remember he was like, in. And, like, I kept, like, running into him. It was a crazy day. So he was, like, trying to, you know, run in, but I was running, like, into him. So he was pretty much, like, pushing me or whatnot. And I was trying to, like, turn my body, but I couldn't do it. I don't know. I think I didn't want to run the 200 that day, but, I mean, I wasn't going to show up like that. I mean, you know, if our curve would have been a lot better, we would have ran a lot faster.
You remember that one as well, Wes?
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. I was so tired after that race.
Well, you're kind of pushing and pulling each other down the track.
Pushing, pulling, and I'm thinking in my head, like, am I calling the wrong man? I don't understand why we're running into each other, but even with all that turmoil, we still ran a faster 200 time than before. So it's basically every time we step on the track, we're setting personal records out there.
The sports story of Lex Gillette began for him in middle school. When all his friends joined the track team, he decided he would too, even though he was blind. He got more serious in high school, joined the wrestling team, and then found that he was great at the standing long jump.
I was, like, one of the best standing long jumpers in our class. So my coach, he was like, you know, I want you to try running long jump. And I was like, are you serious? Like, you really want me to try this?
What was your hesitation, Lex? What were you thinking?
Because I was like, you want me to run, like, down this runway, and I can't see anything. Like, I'm going to fall out and break my neck or something. Like, I just didn't know. And as soon as he showed me, you know, I was like, all right, well, you know, I'll try it. I'll see what it's like. You know, I wasn't really that good at first. I think I would jump like 15, 16 feet or something like that.
How was it with your teammates? How did they treat you?
You know, at first they were probably, you know, like, wow, like, this is wild. But then, like, you know, once my teammates found out my humor and we were always, like, joking around and stuff like that, and we'd help each other out, work out together and stuff like that, and eventually, with their help and, like, the coach's help, and started jumping, like, 18, 19. And then my senior year, I was, like, the best jumper that we had on the team.
How was your self-confidence at the time, Lex? Because, I mean, you know, junior, senior year, high school, it's all about, you know, being cool, meeting girls, playing sports, stuff like that. How was that for you?
It was pretty cool, like, because I had, like, this visual impairment. You always had, like, people, girls and stuff in high school always wanting to help you out and stuff like that. So when I started getting good at long jump and stuff like that, you know, my name was, like going around the school a little bit. It was really cool.
Lex Gillette was soon competing in a number of track and field events, including the 100, the 200 meters, and the 4x100 and the 4x400 relay. His specialty, though, remains the running long jump. in that. He competed in international events, but he remembers distinctly getting the call to participate at the top level for the U.S. in the Paralympics.
I want to say I was leaving my dorm room or something. I was walking somewhere, and someone had called me, and I was like, who is this? So the woman was, like, on the phone. She was like, you know, just want to let you know that we're going to send you this check and all this other stuff. And so immediately, like, that got my attention. And then I remember I, like, called my mom, and I was like, yeah, I don't really know what this is, but...
Was she crying?
Yeah, my mom is always, like, really excited about everything. So I was like, oh, I'm just so proud of you and all this other stuff. But
and you qualified for Greece. You went with the Paralympic team to Greece.
Yeah, I did. Greece was, it was a really long flight. I can remember we were on the plane and everybody was like so excited and stuff and nobody was sleeping and everybody was talking and everything. And eventually I had like passed out when I had woke up. They were like, yeah, you know, we're going to land pretty soon. And I can remember us getting off the plane and like all the Greek girls were like saying hey and stuff like that. And I was just like, man, like this is wild.
Take me to the day that you were competing in Greece. Were you nervous?
Every competition I'm in, I usually get butterflies. It's just like a natural thing for me, I guess. I was getting pretty juiced up. And then we finally like stepped on the track and we were like waving to everybody and the stands were packed and everybody was like yelling. You couldn't really hear too much. Once I like took a couple of run-throughs, I got, you know, adjusted and everything. I started settling down. The way it works is I have a guy runner, and that person stands beside the long jump board.
That's the takeoff board, right? The light place where your foot last touches?
Yeah, the takeoff board. I run down the runway, and he says, like, straight, 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 and he, like, claps his hands or whatnot with it. And as I'm running, I'll basically just count my steps. And when I get to my last step, I just take off and jump. You know, he's just there to, like, you know, make sure that I don't get hurt, make sure I stay on the runway.
Lex, if there's so much noise in the stadium, how can you hear your trainer up at the board giving you directions on the track?
They got on the loudspeaker or whatnot and asked the crowd to like quiet down while everybody was jumping. Everybody would take their jump and then they would scream or whatnot, yell. You know, they had, you know, instructed the crowd when to make noise and when not to, so they had it down pat pretty much.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Lex Gillette was not born blind. He was an active kid. He played with friends in the neighborhood. They rode bikes, had a treehouse. Lex was 7 when he came home from school, took a bath, and noticed that something was wrong with his vision.
And when I had gotten out of the bathtub, I was looking around, and like everything seemed like it was looking a little bit different. The lights were blurry and stuff like that. And I had told my mom, and she was like, you know, maybe you should just go back in the bathroom, wash your eyes out or whatnot, and... you know, everything should be cool. I guess she was just thinking, like, maybe something had gotten in my eyes. So I had still, like, continued to look around, and everything still, like, looked blurry, and I really couldn't, like, see anything in detail. So I had went to sleep and everything, and when I woke up the next morning, it was still the same. And my mom had taken me to the doctor. That's when they had told me that I had a retina detachment.
So back in 1992, Lex was in and out of surgery at least 10 times. His eyes would work for a while, but then his eyesight would get blurry again and he'd have to go back to the hospital. Even though his vision didn't seem to be improving, he stayed active with his mother's encouragement. See, his mother has glaucoma, and she kept telling him that he could do anything he wanted to do.
After a while, the doctor said they really didn't know what else they could do. And so my mom was just like, we'll just have to move on and figure out how to deal with it.
What were you thinking at the time?
I was young, so the only thing I really knew is I couldn't, like, go outside and play with my friends and stuff like that. And I wasn't able to, you know, be in class and write with a pencil and a pen and stuff like that.
Right. So was it serious enough at that point in the early stages that your parents didn't let you ride your bike or, you know, that sort of stuff?
I still would go outside or whatnot because a lot of my friends, I guess they didn't really understand either. So they always were trying to get me to come outside. I can remember like a few times when we would be out there playing and the things that I used to be able to see, I couldn't see it no more. And like, I guess they started noticing it and stuff and they'd be like asking me questions and everything. And I didn't really know what to say because you're so young. I could still remember like going outside and we had like this wall like in front of our apartment. It's probably like 10 feet away from my front steps. And it was just like a 3-foot drop into the grass. And, you know, when I could see really good, we would always like jump off of that and play around on it and stuff like that. And I could still remember, you know, not being able to see it, but I would like jump off it and stuff. And my mom didn't really have too big of a problem with it. But, you know, my grandma was like, that kid is going to kill himself or whatever. And
how did it affect sports at school?
I think I was like a little bit ashamed to like play with some of my other friends and whatnot because of like all the previous times where we used to run around and do everything that we did. But yeah. Now it's like I couldn't do that with them. Sometimes, you know, I would like sit out of things or, you know, wouldn't want to do it because of that.
Lex Gillette would prove to himself that he could overcome his disability in sports. We heard earlier from Lex's training guide, Wes Williams. I asked Wes to tell me just how it works when the two of them run together.
The beginning of the race, we're in the blocks together. We're attached together by a tether. We use a keychain. We tie it a knot in the middle so it could separate us at a significant distance to where I can keep him, you know, close by.
So how long is that keychain?
It's just a regular keychain, probably about 10 inches tied together. And we synchronously get into the blocks together and we start. As soon as we become, like in the 400, say we come off the curve, I'm talking to him. As soon as we get out the blocks, it's like, okay, now we're coming on the bend. I have to tell him when we're in the middle of the at the top of the curve and when we're going to come into the straightaway. And we've been working on that.
And you're close enough to him that you can almost be whispering to him all the time that you're running?
Well, right at this point, I'm yelling. Yeah, I want to make sure my commands to Lexus are as clear as possible. He understands what's going on.
So through and that turn, it would sound like what then?
He's leaning, and I'll say curve, 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 top of the curve, 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 and then prepare for the straight. See? And that's when we focus on synchronizing together and then opening up our stride for the back stretch.
And just so I'm clear, the tether is attached where to you, Lex?
We used to, like, put it around our hand as if we had, like, a...
like a baton or something, right?
Yeah, pretty much like that. But now we just have, like, it tied around our middle finger and our ring finger. So that's how we have like a little bit more distance and I can like have my arm swing and, you know, he can do what he needs to do.
And you have to find his stride and match to it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's where his running style is. So we have to run according to how he is. Because if I'm trying to do my thing and then he's trying to do his, it's going to definitely throw us off.
And you're linked together by this little 10-inch keychain.
Yeah, a little tether, yeah.
If you touch him, are you guys disqualified?
No, not at all. Truthfully, to begin with, we started out with that same keychain, but our forearms would touch. So the closer we were, I mean, I guess it worked on our chemistry better because I got to physically see how he runs, his whole dynamic and everything, his stride pace and everything. But as we got comfortable with each other, we widened it out. So now he can feel like he's running on his own, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I'm running with him. So it works out.
And Lex, how much are you depending on Wes? Is in a good race, can you almost forget that he's there and just focus on being as fast as you can?
Pretty much. Like, I'm always, you know, depending on him and whatnot. I mean, I still feel as though when, you know, we're running that, like, I'm free and, like, I'm relaxed. But at the same time, I'm just, like, you know, always listening to him and always making sure I'm trying to follow his directions and stuff like that. So, you know, we can have a much more successful race.
And will you ask him a question? Will you ask him, you know, where are we? How are we doing? Or
yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I will say, hey, man, where we at? Where we at?
Are we winning?
You know, he'll let me know. But majority of the time, I mean, you know, he's good about, you know, letting me know where I am and stuff like that. And it's just like two learning processes because I had to learn how to run with, you know, the guy runner or whatnot and also learn how to run the race. You know, with Wes, he pretty much just makes sure that I feel as comfortable as I can on the track and just make sure I'm relaxed and, you know, continue to run through the race. I don't know. I know it's hard for me, but it seems, you know, when I put myself in his shoes sometimes, it seems like it'd be, like, even harder for him just because, you know, you have to make sure that somebody, you know, stays in this lane. And this medal depends on, you know, you have something to do with him getting this medal, too.
Wes, I don't know how you do this. I mean, athletes like Lex, well, you're one yourself, so you know. But, I mean, we're talking about people who get really wound up, totally focused, the sort of racehorse mentality. And you've got to somehow be 10 inches away from that person, but out of his space at the same time so he can perform on his own.
Lex is a talented athlete. Well, truthfully, okay, there's a story. It's our second. It's our second 100-meter race that we were running of the season, and our tether broke. And so, from our experience of me calling him on the long jump pit, I was able to use those same commands without the tether to finish the whole 100 race. So we ran about 80 meters without each other connected.
That was like the craziest thing I've ever been in my life. It felt like when we came out of the blocks, I was like, oh man, you know, I was feeling good and everything. And then all of a sudden, like my arm was just like free. I can remember like I had the tether in my hand and I tried to hand it back to him while we were running. He's like, oh man, you know, it's broke. And I was like, oh, man. And so I can remember just, you know, continuing to run. And he was just like, straight. He was like, just keep straight. And I was like, oh, man, what the heck? Like, what is this?
I just kept telling him straight. He just felt me. He felt me next to him. And the guy on the other side of him was able to help because he knew not to run into him, but to stay closer to me. So
I could hear the guy in my left lane. So I was like, okay, you know, I know not to go over there or whatnot. And so then I just came back a little bit in and, you know, just finished the race. But that was like the craziest feeling ever. Like, it's just like somebody just took like your security blanket away, and it was just wild, a crazy feeling.
And Alexis finished the race straight down the whole way. It was amazing. And we put it together. It was, when it was done, I was like, how did we just do that? But we finished it, and we ran good. I wish the tether wouldn't have broke, because that day we ran significantly fast, but I know if we were together, you know, following each other, we would have.
You'd have been better than that.
Yeah.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I'm fascinated by that relationship between the Paralympic runner, Lex Gillette, and his guide, Wes Williams. Wes says he has the kind of role on the track where he's not just the guide, but a coach and trainer, too.
Definitely, because, like he said, it's his first year running, and things to him naturally may not be as correct as a sprinter should. So as far as like what we're working on right now is getting his arm, finding his fluid in his arm to make sure that he's running comfortable and relaxing to where he's not tense and jerking when he runs. So I have to look for things like that just to make sure we get the best race possible, because when we go to Beijing, it's going to be game time, and we're going to make sure we're ready for that.
Are you psyched for this, for Beijing?
Oh, very. You know, my first competition was like I got thrown into the wolves. So we were in Brazil, and I knew I had to keep a calm head, and there's people around just cheering like crazy. I got hoarse from the whole thing, but after I did that, I knew that this is it. Like, we're going to go to Beijing. We're gonna do real well, because we have to. We have to.
And is Lex's success your success?
I would like to say I have a part to do so in that. I can't take all the credit, but I want to say I've been running with him for, in August, it'll be a year. I don't know if Lex is comfortable with me telling people this, but Alexis is good at what he does. Before he came to the training center, all he did was show up at track meets. So he'd come to the track meet and get a gold. The first place, it was easy. It's like nothing. He just show up, fly in, you know, get off the plane and jump. So I can't say I have, you know, everything to do with it, but I would like to say, you know, I want to be a part in what he does.
I need to hear from you, Lex, if you get that medal draped around your neck in Beijing. Is that Wes's medal as well as yours? How do you guys square that?
He's definitely, I mean, it's not either one of our medals, because my mom, like, she'll just, like, take it off my neck after I'm done. But we both have a part of it, just because, I mean, I do the jumping and everything, but, I mean, it would be nothing, you know, if I didn't have, you know, Wes at the long jump board and making sure I was safe and everything and running properly, jumping properly, and, I mean, just doing everything. So it's like a mutual relationship. And so when I succeed, he succeeds.
During the Paralympics in Athens in 2004, Alexis Gillette won a silver in the running long jump. The gold went to a young man from China, and Lex will compete against that same young man again this summer in Beijing. We'll stay in touch with him and with Wes and see how they do. If you have your own story of courage and determination, overcoming odds to succeed at something, I'd like to hear about it. Just send me a couple of lines. Go to our website. You can find me at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Mm-hmm.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.